Gentlemen, our first case for argument this morning is Natural Resources Defense Council against Jackson. Mr. O'Brien.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Colin O'Brien, and I'm here from Earth Justice arguing on behalf of the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Sierra Club. I'm joined by co-counsel John Walk and David Bender. The Clean Air Act requires that in order for EPA to approve the Wisconsin regulations that are at issue in this case, that those regulations must not collectively result in any increased air pollution. Wisconsin proposed to adopt three regulatory provisions in the changes at issue here. One is a new 10-year look-back period for evaluating whether a source's emissions constitute an increase that triggers the new source review program. The second is a new actual to projected actual emissions test, which is also used for determining applicability of the NSR program. And third is a provision that institutes plant-wide applicability limits, or PALs, which are source-wide caps that allow facilities to make changes and increase emissions without triggering NSR. EPA has not engaged in reasoned decision-making in reaching its conclusion that the net effect of the three rulemaking provisions will not increase emissions. With respect to the 10-year look-back and the revised emissions test, EPA has itself acknowledged that the provisions are more lenient and result in increased emissions. These admissions about emissions have been verified by analysis of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, which conducted the only empirical analysis of the effects of the 10-year look-back and revised emissions test and concluded that the regulations would lead to many hundreds of tons of additional pollution. EPA never reviewed the study, and it dismissed the conclusions of the study summarily. Without having undertaken any substantive analysis of the emissions consequences of the 10-year
Counsel, in how many states has the 2002 approach been put into application?
I don't know the exact number, but I believe that it is many.
And what do we know about actual emissions in those states? Do we know anything in this record about actual emissions in those states?
In this record, we know absolutely nothing.
Well, that's a problem, is it not? In the D.C. Circuit, the New York decision in 2005 said that the kind of argument being made now can't be done at the level of theory. It has to be done at the level of data. That's what it meant to say it was unripe. And so one would think that the way to get data is to look at states that have put this into force. If emissions go up, we know there's a problem. If emissions don't go up, we know there's not a problem. But without looking at what happened, we can't tell whether there's a problem or not. That was the D.C. Circuit's point.
Well, I think what the D.C. Circuit said was at the national level, it was okay that EPA was going to predict that there wouldn't be emissions increases. But that was a conclusion that they said
right.
only was
predictions
good
have to be checked against the world.
Right.
But that's the problem I have with your argument. You're not trying to check the EPA's models against the world. You're trying to contest the EPA's models with contrary lawyers' arguments. And that's what the D.C. Circuit said wouldn't work.
Well, I would offer several observations that I think are helpful. First, EPA has done absolutely no modeling in this case.
No,
there's
new
none
modeling.
In the record. The only analysis that has been undertaken was undertaken by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And I think it's important to look at the analysis they did because it's very straightforward and it's very telling. They said, let's look at all of the permits that were issued in 2002 under the NSR program. Let's then take these new applicability provisions, the new provisions of the reform rule, and assess of the 24 permits that were issued, which would be foregone, which wouldn't be necessary, which wouldn't be in existence under the revised regulations. And they found that in a number of instances...
I don't see how... First, you know, one theoretical prediction against another theoretical prediction, the agency is going to win. But I don't see how counting permits is going to help. You need to know aggregate emissions.
Right. Well, what WDNR did was not limited to counting permits. What they did is that they identified that a certain number of those permits would not have been issued under the new rules, and as a consequence, without triggering the permit requirements, certain facilities in the states would not be subject to best available control technology or the non-attainment equivalent, and as a consequence, emissions would go up. WDNR calculated specific figures for NOx, for particulate matter, and I believe also for SO2, and found that emissions would go up by many hundreds of tons in each instance. If you look at the record at page JA119, that's where WDNR affixes particular numbers to the emissions increases that are expected. And what's important here is that EPA has never engaged the substance of WDNR's analysis. It dismissed it in a conclusory fashion and never has given its own reasons for why the study is wrong. It simply adopted conclusory reasons that WDNR itself had given for backtracking. And two layers of conclusory statements doesn't equal a refutation of an empirical analysis. Moreover, EPA hasn't done any...
That actually sounds like what the D.C. Circuit said in the National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting case dealing with diversity in radio and TV broadcasting, and the Supreme Court reversed it unanimously. It said that if there are two predictions, one made by the agency and one made by people outside the agency wins.
Well, I think
you can test predictions only with results. That's the holding of the Supreme Court, and we're not going to disagree.
No, but I would focus on the language in the New York versus EPA decision, which said that EPA's predictions are only deferred to in instances where they're backed by substantial evidence. And in this case, EPA hasn't marshaled any evidence to defend the prospect that emissions won't increase in Wisconsin. And here I think it's critical that we focus on what was the reason that EPA actually gave for concluding that the 10-year look-back and the revised emissions test wouldn't lead to emissions increases in Wisconsin. And that's based on three sentences that appear at the bottom of page 11 and the top of page 12 in the record. Basically, what EPA said was, well, we think it's a little bit difficult to assess the impact of these two provisions, but we note that the federal rulemaking considered these provisions and found that there was a net national environmental benefit. But the problem with that is that if you look at the national level analysis itself, it declared that the study could not predict when or where emissions changes would occur. The federal level analysis itself suggested that it could, or not suggested, but held that it had serious limitations and it could not be applied to any particular area. So when looking at the basis for EPA's decision that this will lead to net environmental benefits, it basically boils down to that one sentence on the bottom of page 11, where EPA says that the supplemental analysis determined that there is a slight national environmental benefit brought about by these NSR reform provisions. But the federal analysis, like I said, was disclaimed by EPA as being applicable to particular localities. I would note also that we're essentially looking at envisioning a scale in this case. EPA is claiming that there will be benefits associated with the plant-wide applicability limits, and they're basically betting that those benefits will outweigh the increased emissions that will be associated with the 10-year look-back and the revised emissions test. But their analysis on PALS itself is completely faulty and arbitrary. PALS are entirely voluntary. It's unclear if anyone will ever adopt them, producing emissions benefits. In fact, no source in Wisconsin to date has even applied for one, to our knowledge. Moreover, EPA only calculated the benefits of PALS for a single pollutant. The single source that they consider to be the biggest potential beneficiary of PALS is no longer in operation. And also the emissions, remember, they ascribed particular numbers to PALS. They calculated that a certain number or a certain tonnage of VOCs would be prevented from being emitted in Wisconsin based on PALS. That number is smaller than the number.
Would you, by the way, treat us as what we are, that is, generalists to whom the alphabet soup of the briefs might as well be Finnish.
Okay. Well, maybe this is maybe.
I would say that I had a particularly hard time grappling with that, looking at the briefs. I think it would have been really helpful for somebody to give us a list of all the acronyms and everything. So when you come across something on page 35 that's been mentioned earlier, you don't have to go back and find out what the heck PALS means or something else.
Certainly saves our law clerks, who I had to have mine actually create a chart for me. I couldn't keep it straight.
Thank you, and apologies for the jargon. But then let me then refocus then on this analogy of the scale. If you look at Section 193 of the Act, as well as Section 110L, it says that when EPA is going to approve SIP provisions, it has to make sure that...
No, there you go again.
I'm sorry. When EPA is approving changes to a state's plan for implementing the Act, it must make sure that on its face, the package of revised regulations is neutral on emissions. Certain provisions may increase emissions, but any backsliding overall must be prevented by a net neutral effect in areas that have not attained the clean air standards. So the focus in this case is we're talking about areas of the country where air quality is already compromised, people are already breathing unhealthy air, and if EPA is going to approve new state measures, Section 193 and 110L say that you can only approve a package if the overall net impact of that package is zero. In this particular instance...
Or better.
Pardon?
Or better.
Or better, yes. I mean, better is actually what EPA in its federal rules and states in their modifications ordinarily aspire to. In this case, there are three regulations, two on one side of the scale and a third on the other. If you look at these plant-wide caps, these plant-wide applicability limits, EPA is projecting, although we dispute the projection, that it will produce reductions in emissions, that that's a net positive. But the numbers that they have projected are, we think, overestimated and faulty. But in any event, on the other side of the scale, you have two provisions that describe or provide when sources will trigger their entrance into the new source review program. The triggering provisions are important because if a facility modifies or changes its operations in a way that increases emissions, it's subject to this NSR program, and the NSR program requires the facility to install technology which dramatically reduces emissions. So naturally, sources are interested in avoid triggering these requirements and these reductions if they don't need to. But WDNR, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, sat down and assessed what would be the consequence of these two provisions that determine applicability, and they calculated that the increase in emissions associated with the new provisions would be many hundreds of tons per year. So not only is that many hundreds of tons per year, but it applies to three different pollutants, and the number dwarfs the number that EPA calculated as the benefit on the other side of the equation. Now, I think important to emphasize that, as I said before, EPA never disputes the calculations of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They summarily dismiss WDNR's analysis based on the fact that the agency backtracked from it at one point. But the obligation of EPA isn't to take the conclusory statements of Wisconsin and adopt it as its own, but the burden to make sure that this rulemaking package doesn't exceed the requirements of the statute lies on EPA itself. So not only did EPA never look at the study from the state of Wisconsin, they subsequently dismissed it in conclusory terms. They also dismissed it without acknowledging a caveat that Wisconsin itself noted. I realized that we're trying to avoid the risk of confusion. So in 2003, WDNR concluded unequivocally that this rulemaking package would increase emissions in the state of Wisconsin. They subsequently backtracked from that conclusion, which is why we're here. They adopted the regulations nonetheless. And in backtracking, what they did is they attributed some weight to the experience of Michigan. Now, there's no data about Michigan in the record, but apparently officials in Wisconsin were told by officials in Michigan.
We come back to my opening question. Isn't that a problem? You're the party that wants the EPA's decision upset. It seems that what we've got is the EPA's model, which predicts no change or better, Wisconsin's current view, which predicts no change or better, and on the other side, we've got, well, lawyers' arguments.
I think what we have on our side is the 2003 analysis, which nobody has refuted. Also, please take note, EPA has not done any modeling in this case. The federal level evaluation of this rulemaking was entirely qualitative. It was not quantitative. And like I said, the federal analysis itself said that it couldn't predict with any particularity where emissions reductions or benefits would occur. Also, although EPA tries to stand behind the federal analysis, it's important to hold EPA to its own admissions that the 10-year look-back and the revised emissions test will lead to increased emissions. For example, if you look at the record at page 44 to 45, EPA acknowledged that with a 10-year look-back, facilities might have a higher baseline, and that would trigger the NSR permitting requirements in fewer instances. Also, if you look at that record at page 46 and 47, EPA acknowledged that higher emissions are possible under the 10-year look-back.
That's an argument that was made in the D.C. Circuit. It was rejected by the D.C. Circuit. It's a lawyer's argument. It's a, sure, it might happen. There are a lot of things that might happen. But the bottom line in the D.C. Circuit was we need to know what does happen.
Well, the D.C., it's important, I think, to consider the context of the D.C. Circuit decision versus this one. At bottom, the D.C. Circuit was evaluating a facial challenge to the NSR reform regulation.
Exactly. That's why what might happen won't work. We need to know what does happen.
I think the best gauge of what will happen is holding EPA to its own admissions that emissions will increase. I'll note, for example, that very recently before this court in the Synergy case, EPA stated very plainly that the revised emissions test was less stringent. Also, EPA has categorized.
So are you surprised to see that Synergy, which was the polluter in that case, was saying this is a death blow for us. It's caused terrible problems. And the district court in the Synergy case said in order to comply with the new rule, you have to shut down, totally shut down a new plant. I mean, it's certainly based on what happened in Synergy, it looks like the new approach was substantially reducing emissions. It hardly supports your view.
Well, I would note first that the provisions at issue in Synergy were specific to the state of Indiana. It wasn't a SIP that was identical to the state implementation that's at issue here. Moreover, the state implementation plan that was discussed in Synergy was, like I said, not only different, but the history of, and this is set forth in our brief, but the test that Wisconsin exists here is not a death blow. It reflects the consistently stated congressional purpose, which is when you're evaluating areas of the country where air quality is already poor, the intention of the act is for air quality to improve and to never retreat. And so to the extent that results in restrictions upon enterprise, that's consistent with the overall purpose of the act, but also the very specific language that Congress adopted in Section 193 and in 110L, which EPA basically sidesteps in this case by offering no analysis. I see, though, that I'm into my rebuttal time, and so unless you have any further questions, I'll reserve the rest.
Certainly, Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Berman.
Good Good morning. My name is Amanda Berman. I'm with the Department of Justice representing respondent EPA. Petitioners challenge EPA's approval of three changes that Wisconsin has made to its Clean Air Act state implementation plan, each of which addresses when a facility will be subject to pre-construction review and permitting, and each of which tracks the changes that were made to the federal regulations in 2002.
Ms. Berman, I have pretty much mirror image questions for you than I had for Mr. O'Brien. How many states now have implemented something based on the 2002 revised rules?
I can't say for certain. The EPA's belief is that it's about half of them.
About half of them.
And
what do we know about what has happened to emissions in that half? I gather from Mr. O'Brien that as far as this record goes, we know nothing. But do we know anything in any other way?
Well, I would disagree with that statement. I think from this record, we do know, in fact, that in the state of Michigan, the state of Wisconsin noted that in Michigan, which has historically had similar numbers of permit applications, similar types of facilities, there's been no decrease in the number of facilities going through the NSR process as a result of
changes. I said to Mr. O'Brien, I don't really care how many facilities are going through the permitting process. There are all sorts of other changes. There are people who might not be applying for permits because they're going to make changes that are too minor to be picked up on the new rules. No. I'm really interested in the bottom line. Do we know anything about the bottom line in these 25 states?
We do, I will say, only for Michigan. They also observed that there had been at least no substantial increases in emissions. And I do think that the no decrease in applications is important because petitioner's key argument here is, again, that these three provisions are necessarily going to result in less people going through the NSR process, and Michigan's observed that's not the case, at least in Michigan. We are still in the process of implementing, so we do not think we're at the point yet where one has any reason to say that EPA's conclusion, the conclusion it reached when it looked at this nationally and the conclusion that it reaffirmed when it looked at this in the specific context of Wisconsin, is wrong. There's simply no data that shows that yet. We think petitioner's challenge fails for three reasons. First, because EPA has done the analysis and review that the Clean Air Act requires of it in Section 193 and 110L. Second, because petitioners point to no state-specific data or analysis that shows that EPA's conclusion to the contrary is wrong. And third, because what petitioners do instead is make the same broad brush facial arguments that were rejected by the D.C. Circuit in New York v. EPA. When it approved the incorporation of the three changes at issue into the Wisconsin State Implementation Plan, EPA did do exactly what Section 193 and 110L require of it. It reviewed and it analyzed each, and it reaffirmed its conclusion that none of these provisions would result in emissions increases, and that rather they would have a neutral to beneficial impact collectively on the environment. Looking first at the 2 in 10 provision regarding how to calculate changes in emissions for purposes of figuring out if the modification is major, EPA's assessment was that at both the national and the state level, very few sources would possibly be able to pick a higher baseline and thus avoid the NSR process when they made such a change because of that provision. It would only apply in the first place to about 10% of all sources potentially subject to new source review. It doesn't apply to new sources, electric utilities, sources where emissions had been highest in recent years or stable, which comprised the other 90%. Of that 10%, EPA projected that 70% of those would not be able to reach back in time and pick some higher two-year period baseline. And that's because emissions limits or operating restrictions had been imposed on them during that past 10 years, and the baseline has to reflect those. Now, one might look at that and say, well, that does leave 3%, and that's still a relaxation of prior requirements, except that the prior federal and state regulations allowed any source to ask the state to go back in time and use a different two-year period baseline, and there was no time limitation then. So it's hard to even say that fewer modifications are going to trigger NSR as a result. But even if that's the case, one of the fundamental ideas behind these provisions in the 2002 rule and as implemented here is that even if fewer sources might be subject to new source review as a result of making changes, that doesn't mean there's going to be more emissions. On the contrary, sources will no longer have a disincentive to make technological upgrades that would actually reduce actual emissions overall. And the D.C. Circuit has said that this behavioral projection that EPA has made is a reasonable one. Now, in regard to the actual to projected actual provision, EPA's analysis was that although it might result in fewer modifications qualifying as major and thus triggering NSR, it would preserve the benefits of the permits that those facilities already have in place because they're major emitting facilities. If a source does the calculation and the result is that it will not have a significant net emissions increase, then that means that it has to stay within the emissions limits that are already applying to it under its current permit. It has to report any exceedances of those limits. So if it was wrong, the state will know. I think it's worth noting that the state of Wisconsin has chosen to have stricter reporting requirements than are required by the federal regulations. And finally, in regard to the PAL program, the plant applicability limitation, EPA went beyond qualitatively analyzing whether the prediction of the program's effects at the national level would be the same in Wisconsin. And it actually modeled what the results in Wisconsin might look like. It looked at what types of facilities are prevalent in Wisconsin, reasoning which of those are likely to make use of this program. And it looked at specifically paper manufacturers as well as auto industry manufacturers, because these types of facilities make frequent changes, and thus they're likely to want to be part of this program so that they don't have to go through NSR every time they do so. EPA then conservatively estimated how many such facilities might apply for a plant applicability limitation, and then conservatively calculated what emissions reductions would result if they did. And the result was that for the paper manufacturers alone, EPA predicted that implementing the program in Wisconsin would result in between 83 and 276 tons per year of VOCs reduced. And VOCs is one key type of pollutant here. It's an ozone precursor, and ozone is one of the two pollutants for which Wisconsin is, in fact, in non-attainment. Therefore, we think it was particularly appropriate for EPA to use that as its example pollutant. Now, EPA didn't stop at looking at how these three provisions are going to apply in Wisconsin. It also looked at how they would interact with Wisconsin's state implementation plan and its regulatory framework more broadly. One thing that further assured EPA that no emissions increases would result was that Wisconsin's minor source regulations were revised at the same time so as to catch sources that might avoid the NSR process because of these changes and put them under certain limitations. Specifically, they have to do modeling to show that their emissions will not result in a national ambient air quality standard violation or an increment violation. This is not required by the federal rule, and it's entirely appropriate for EPA to consider this as support for its conclusion that the overall impact of the three reform provisions in Wisconsin is going to be what it had predicted at the national level. Now, I'd like to turn to the second reason that the substance of petitioners' challenge to EPA's approval of these three provisions fails, and that's because petitioners bring nothing to the table that shows anything different than what EPA concluded. The only thing petitioners point to at all is a 2003 PowerPoint presentation done by somebody at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources that includes several conclusory statements to the contrary. But that document, frankly, doesn't establish much of anything. It certainly can't bear the enormous weight that petitioners are placing on it here. In its reply brief, petitioners asserted for the first time that this study actually established that 809 additional tons per year of VOCs and 992 additional tons per year of particulate matter would be emitted as a result of these changes. It does not do that. If you look at the page cited by petitioners, which is at Joint Appendix page 119, it contains conclusory statements that these amounts of VOCs and PM, quote unquote, were prevented from going in the air due to PSD/NSR regs. That means by the existence of these programs overall. So this statement doesn't even say that this is the change that's going to result from these three minor changes to the rule. It's saying that's what the program does overall. And there's no basis in any event for those numbers. There's no way to know how they arrived at those two numbers. And the state of Wisconsin itself questioned the validity of this 2003 PowerPoint. It noted in a 2006 report that, A, the 2003 document is undercut by the fact that it didn't look at the plant applicability limitation program at all, and also by the fact that the state of Michigan has not experienced any drop-off in permit applications as projected in the 2003 document. And it's in its amicus brief here, the state of Wisconsin says again that the conclusions from that 2003 document were put into significant doubt by the time the 2006 report was written. It also calls them cursory, and it calls petitioners' reliance on them exaggerated and misplaced. And this is the state of Wisconsin's assessment of its own document. Thus, we don't think this document is sufficient to rebut EPA's conclusions. It has no substance. Petitioners admit it doesn't include the PAL program in its analysis, and the state of Wisconsin itself has backed away from it and come to opposite conclusions. And this is all petitioners have to offer. They offer no other data or analysis that indicates that EPA's projections about the impacts of these changes in Wisconsin are wrong. As the Fifth Circuit said in the GASP case addressing a Section 110L challenge, where the petitioners offer nothing to contradict the EPA's conclusions, it is entitled to deference. The final reason that petitioners' challenge to the approval of the Wisconsin State Implementation Plan revisions fails is that rather than being based on hard data or even a state-specific qualitative analysis, this challenge is made based on the same facial attacks rejected by the D.C. Circuit in New York v. EPA. Petitioners are absolutely correct when they say that their challenge to these revisions is neither unripe nor barred as a matter of res judicata. We agree that this is the right and the only time to challenge EPA's approval of the Wisconsin State Implementation Plan revisions. But what EPA is saying is that such a challenge can't succeed based on the same non-state-specific facial arguments that were unsuccessfully made in New York v. EPA. Now, EPA laid these arguments side by side in its brief, so I won't go through each of them now. But in general terms, the heart of the challenges raised in the New York case to the changes at issue here was that they would necessarily result in less sources being subject to NSR. And therefore, necessary result of that was that there would be more emissions. That's exactly the same thing that petitioners are arguing here. But in New York v. EPA, the court said that EPA is entitled to make a predictive judgment based on its experience and expertise that emissions were not likely to increase even if fewer changes made at major facilities triggered new source review and permitting as a result of the 2002 rule.
Counsel, you may remember, you know, I'm harping on the question, do we have data? But you may remember a different sequence in the D.C. Circuit. I mentioned that an FCC case, National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting, which said an agency can get by with predictions. But the D.C. Circuit then said about, turns out to be 16 years later, in Bechtel against the FCC, that after there is data has come up, if an agency just sticks with predictions in the face of data and doesn't pay any attention to data, time has run out. The agencies can start with predictions, but it's got to go to real numbers when real numbers are available. That's why I'm trying to figure out whether there are real numbers. And I want to express my puzzlement to both sides, not only that we've been in this business now for some years, apparently without real numbers, but the numbers both sides are counting seem to be numbers of permits rather than quantities of emissions, and it's the latter the Act is worried about. One is not worried about pollution of permits by having too many or too few of them.
Well, Judge Easterbrook, I would simply say that that's what we have so far, and I understand it's not a lot. I would note that actually, you know, for states that didn't have their own state implementation plan, NSR, non-attainment new source review provisions, the federal implementation plan goes into effect. So those are the first states to have any experience. And so in a handful of states, that would have happened in late 2003 or shortly thereafter, but that's mm-hmm. a handful. Most states weren't required to do their revisions until 2006. And now those revisions are, in many states, being challenged, and this is actually the first case to address those. So we are still very much at the end.
Do you know of any others? I've learned of one more. There's one pending in the Sixth Circuit. Are there any that you know of pending anywhere else?
I actually am only aware of the Sixth Circuit one offhand. I do know this is the first challenge to incorporating the three federal provisions exactly into a state SIP.
9 years after the EPA changed its rules, which was itself the end of a very long process.
And as you may remember, even when the 1980 rule was promulgated, it took, I think in Wisconsin, parts of it were only implemented in 1995. It's unfortunate, but that does this sort of time lapse.
Yeah, there was a big lag in Indiana, too, as we learned in Synergy. And, in fact, they got it wrong, and EPA missed that and approved the wrong provision until Indiana got that fixed. Wasn't it something in the Clean Air Act of 1970? Wasn't there a clause that said all pollution will cease by 1975? Or was it 78?
Well, Congress did go back a few times and attain the deadline. We agree with petitioners that, you know, non-attainment is a one-way street. And actually, Wisconsin has been in attainment. Standards were tightened, and that has resulted in them falling out. But EPA's conclusion is that these revisions are not going to interfere with their attainment. In fact, and I will say this knowing it's outside the record, my understanding from EPA is that for ozone, technically the counties that were non-attainment have all met the attainment numbers. They just haven't been redesignated yet. But EPA's conclusion, based on the analysis it did nationally, based on thinking about how that applies to Wisconsin with, you know, the little Wisconsin-specific data we have, the modeling about how the plant-wide applicability limitations will apply there, looking at Wisconsin's specific mm-hmm. regulatory framework.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Berman. Mr. Nickel.
I'm Henry Nickel. I represent intervener respondents in this case. And I'd like to focus my time today on really two things. First, what is the legal standard that governs this court's review of the final action which is before this court? And second, what is the role of projections as to the efficacy of the permit program Wisconsin adopted? And what is the role of actual performance under that program, under the Clean Air Act? As to the fundamental question, Section 110A2C of the Clean Air Act states clearly the standard that...
Could you also do me a favor? Maybe I should have asked for this at the same time I asked Mr. O'Brien to use real English words. Could you use the numbers that are in the United States Code? Only a specialist knows that Section 113 is actually Section 74.10.3.2 sub. You get the idea.
I get the idea, and I actually wrote it down on the top
Thank
of my
you.
Paper.
It's so much easier to look things up in the U.S. Code than their real numbers. Pardon?
42 U.S.C. 7410.
7410L, okay.
Right. That provision calls upon the states to submit a pre-construction permit program as required under Part C and Part D. Part C is the so-called Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program, Clean Air Program, and Part D is Non-Attainment Program. The program required is specified in EPA regulations, EPA's Part 51 regulations. That's where EPA projects the consequences from an admission standpoint of various regulatory options within its discretion and chooses among them. The very important thing to remember about the new source review program is it's not the beginning and the end of regulation of emissions. are emission increases that are authorized without a permit. So more has to be done than just have a permit program, and the Clean Air Act contemplates that. The time for evaluating the consequence of regulatory options ceased when EPA finalized those rules and the D.C. Circuit affirmed those rules. The question for this court with respect to the Wisconsin program was, does it meet those rules? Now, what about the future? The future is very important because under the Clean Air Act, you have to have a pre-construction permit program. But under 42 U.S.C. 7410A2A, you have to have enforceable emission limitations and other controls as necessary to meet the requirements of Part D, which is the non-attainment requirements, as necessary to assure attainment and maintenance of ambient standards. So when you look at the performance, the actual performance under the permit programs that the states adopt that meet the EPA legislative rules, and you find that emissions are going up, the state is obligated then to impose limits to control those emissions. And as I said, there's going to be sources under any permit program that are not going to have to get a permit but are going to have emissions increases. If emissions go up, EPA also, it may be incumbent upon EPA to reevaluate the new source review program. In other words, no longer rely on a projection that said this is the best option. It's not the best option. Change the rules.
Well, is Wisconsin or the EPA gathering the data that will enable them to make that decision?
Yes, but it has nothing to do with whether or not the administrator should have approved the Wisconsin program or what this court should decide in determining the acceptability of EPA's action.
Well, I assume it won't affect us because, as Mr. O'Brien said, no such data are in this administrative record. But eventually one would expect data from Wisconsin will be in the administrative record of Oregon and data from New York will end up in the administrative record of Wisconsin the next time around. And somebody will actually be able to make that decision.
And when they do make that distinction, the response should not be that you can't get that program approved. The response should be you have to do something more under other provisions of 7410 in order to assure attainment and maintenance of the standards. The final point that I'd make is that for the reasons stated in our brief, the so-called anti-backsliding provision, 42 U.S.C. 7515, that petitioners principally rely on, is simply inapplicable in this case. That is a savings provision that first saved the regulations in place in 1990. And until they're changed in accordance with the 1990 amendments. And then it has a more limited savings clause directed at control requirements in effect or required to be adopted by an order, settlement agreement, or plan in effect on November of 1990. The plan in effect in 1990 was virtually identical to the one Chief Judge Easterbrook, that you had before you in the Synergy case, namely a potential emissions test, which was less stringent than the test that was adopted by Wisconsin when they established the new source review program implementing the 2002 rules. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. O'Brien?
I have four. The court will indulge me, the first point that I'd like to make is that EPA counsel, in setting at length her refutation of the WDNR study in 2003, spent a lot more time talking about it before you than EPA ever did in the record. EPA simply never engaged the study. Also, although counsel for EPA suggests that the numbers that were set forth by WDNR were not explained, I believe that she overlooks pages 140 to 150 of the joint appendix, where upon reconsideration, we submitted additional data from Wisconsin, which included examples that set forth the way WDNR undertook its calculations. But the second point that I want to make is that to the extent that EPA is trying to rely on predictive judgment here, I think that that is inconsistent with the statutory provisions at issue. Both Section 7410 and 7515 require that the agency undertake reasoned decision-making in the first instance when they approve changes to state implementation plans. It's not good enough for them to throw their hands up and say they don't really know and make a commitment to evaluate the outcome later. That, I think, is a hallmark of arbitrary and capricious decision-making, and coincidentally, or significantly, actually, I should say, it violates the standard that EPA has itself said applies to its decisions under Section 193, or 7515. If I could draw your attention to page 235 of the Joint Appendix, EPA has itself said that 7515 is extraordinarily rigid. That's an impression that's reinforced by their study of the legislative history, and it doesn't even allow de minimis exceptions to the idea that an amendment to a state implementation plan must not, in a non-attainment area, result in new emissions. Now, the third point I'd like to make is to discuss quickly Michigan, because I know it's of interest to Judge Easterbrook. And I know that you're not interested in talking about changes in the total number of permits, but I'll highlight that the information on Michigan was not completely silent on the issue of emissions. If you look to page 155, where WDNR was summarizing its assessment of what happened in Michigan, it said, sure, they haven't seen a change in the number of permits. And with respect to emissions, it said, nor have significant increases in emissions resulting in new non-attainment areas occurred. So implicit in that statement is that emissions have increased, just not emissions to such a grotesque extent that it has required the classification of new areas in violation of health standards. And again, maybe referring back to the standard that I referred to under sections 7410L and section 7515, those are exacting standards that require EPA to make sure that there's no backsliding. I'll note that with respect to 7410, counsel for EPA cites the GASP case as being governing in this case. I think that that's an odd selection. If you look at that GASP case, it was unpublished, and the opinion says on its face that it's not precedential. So I would refer instead to the authorities that are cited in our brief. Finally, I would like to note that I think almost the entirety of Intervenors Council's brief amounts to post hoc rationalizations of counsel. And under the Supreme Court's Chenery precedent, as well as this Court's decision in Moab versus Gonzalez, it's been well established that counsel arguing before the Court is not entitled to provide justifications that the agency did not consider. And in this case, most of the positions taken in the intervener's brief were not only not in the record, and they were never passed upon by EPA, but in many cases, they stand completely contrary to longstanding EPA position. So to the extent that you're inclined to credit virtually anything in intervener's brief, I would suggest that that actually militates in favor of remand, because ultimately the positions intervener's take should be subject to public discussion. They should be subject to EPA being able to take the first crack at these novel interpretations of the regulations and the statutes, and this Court should have the benefit of EPA's impressions before ruling. So, there are no further questions.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the Court will take a brief recess before the second case this morning.
Yeah, Judge Easterwood must have taken his.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I got another one. I got another calendar.
You do? Okay. Already here, actually. This is all Judge Everly, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Should be his, too. You got a what?
I got no time.
No, you ain't going to have time. Could you make a copy or something? Wait a minute, I got one. Just.
Would you roll it in?
Good morning.